Cabernet tends to be the sort of Errol Flynn of the grape varieties.
One of Australia's leading beer judges.
People always ask, how do you get involved in sake and how does that connect to music?
Because wine is an adventure.
Conventional winemakers who just condemn all natural wine as faulty.
The prestigious title of Sake Samurai.
Looking at whiskey in more of an artful culinary way.
The difference between getting good quality fresh hops, it just translates straight through into the beer.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. One of Australia's leading authorities on wine, Andrew Kayard, has been a key figure in shaping Australia's fine wine agenda for over 25 years. Andrew is a wine marketing graduate of Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia, and he passed the Master of Wine examination in 1993. He founded Langton's, Australia's leading wine auction house, which was acquired by Woolworths in 2009. Since then, Andrew has been the fine wine principal at Pinnacle Drinks, a division of Endeavour Drinks Australia, the Woolworths subsidiary behind retailers such as Dan Murphy's and BWS. This year, Andrew published a new book called Imagining Coonawarra, which tells the story of how Wynn's founder John Riddick pioneered the Coonawarra region. I could go on about Andrew's highly decorated career, but today he's here to talk about the debut of two Australian wines, Wynn's John Riddick Cabernet Sauvignon and Jim Barry the Armagh Shiraz, on the prestigious international wine marketplace, La Place de Bordeaux. I started by asking Andrew why this milestone is so important for Australian wine.
Well, the La Place de Bordeaux is a very traditional marketplace, but it reaches almost every corner of the world. It's really a stock exchange for wine, and it operates out of Bordeaux, and it's run by several hundred negociants of various shapes and sizes. And it's really the most important market for fine wine in the world, particularly for Bordeaux. But over the last 10 years, the Bordeaux negociants and La Place de Bordeaux have included international wines as well. And some of those are really quite famous. So from Italy, from Bulgari, there's Onalaya and Masetto, and from California, Opus One and Joseph Phelps. So there hasn't been any Australian wine on the Place de Bordeaux, not in the way that it's been offered, where through multiple negociants. And so it's significant because it's a kind of an appreciation among Bordeaux negociants that Australia is making some of the finest wines in the world. And that's been a pretty difficult nut to crack. So it is, it's meaningful, definitely.
Why has it taken so long?
Well, I think markets evolve more than anything else. And the way that Australian wine is distributed and promoted around the world is really more in the kind of masstige or commercial wine area. And certainly in terms of the politics of Australian wine, I think the energy has really been into kind of moving volume and boxes, and which has been a pretty effective way of selling Australian wine. But I think the Australian premium wine, or ultra fine wine as I call it, has really been in the shadow of that kind of momentum. Not completely. I mean, there have been enough kind of promotions by Wine Australia around the world to show that it has an interest in ultra fine Australian wine, and has been doing quite a lot, and even if you look at its website. But generally, because ultra fine wine is expensive, it lands up being more of a niche market. It doesn't really reach into a general market.
Sure. Mm. Now, these two particular wines, I mean, obviously there's no shortage of premium Cabernet and premium Shiraz in Australia. Why these two wines particularly? What are their attributes?
Well, what I think is really interesting to say, and this is just the point about ultra-fine wine, and by your question, really kind of illuminates what I just said beforehand, and that is that that kind of question, there's a lot of Shiraz and there's a lot of Cabernet Sauvignon, but the reality is there isn't a lot of very fine Shiraz and fine Cabernet Sauvignon. And, there are a lot of things that go into making really, top quality wine. And it's not only in terms of the vineyard and the clonal selections and the yields and all of that kind of stuff. aspect, you know, the whole terroir, as they call it, of the vineyards, but it's also what's happening in the winery and the winemaking philosophies that take place. And then on top of that, you've got the narrative. And so you've got this very, very complex, layered, you know, kind of stories that come with ultra-fine wine. And they're very, very difficult to replicate. They're very difficult to establish. And when we're talking about Winge John Riddick, Kunawara Cabernet Sauvignon, and Jim Barry Amar, which is from the Clare Valley in South Australia, you're talking about two wines that have really kind of stood the test of time. They're in Langton's classification of Australian wine at the exceptional level. They're really, really well-regarded collector's wines. They're sensational, you know, wines. They've got a track record of cellaring and all of those kind of things. And so it's those kind of things that make these wines different to the common garden Australian wine, for want of a better phrase.
We're obviously talking about a lot more than just price point here, because there has been a real proliferation of Shiraz, for example, in Australia that above the $100 price point in recent years. But what you're talking about is that the wines need a lot more than just a, you know, a big price point to be put on them.
Yeah, look, you know, there are, and there are a lot of wineries that produce $100 wines which aren't worth $100 wines. So, you know, they use the word icon. I call them icon. You know, they're just not, you know, they're wines that really don't really articulate the values of what a really ultra-fine wine is. And then conversely to that, there are wines that are only $20 or $30 of what, $30 a bottle that really should be at a much higher price level. So it just shows you the complexities of ultra-fine wine and, you know, the emotional response and the philosophical, you know, kind of issues that come with fine wine. It's very, very different to commercial wine.
You've spent a lot of time in Bordeaux. What is the perception of Australian wine currently over there?
Oh, in Bordeaux, well, you know, when I first started traveling to Bordeaux, which was a hell of a long time ago, Australian wines were respected, of course. But very few negociants who are the people who particularly trade in the wines were particularly excited about Australian wines. You know, it was something, you know, that was taking place, you know, kind of on the other side of the world. The markets were fairly limited for Australian wine, basically the United States and the UK, a few Scandinavian countries, and of course China, which has been a big deal in recent times. But as far as Bordeaux Négociants concerned, you know, in some respects, you know, it was, you know, something that was really, you know, off piste, so to speak. And certainly from the producer's point of view, from the chateaus, etc., to some degree, there might have been a feeling of competition as well.
I think we have a feeling in this country that our wine industry is so much younger than it is in France, and that Bordeaux's been doing Cabernet for so much longer than we have here.
Yeah.
But Cabernet's connection with Australia actually goes back a lot further than people might think,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it does. It goes back a hell of a long time. And in fact, you know, just going back again, you know, there's so much bullshit about fine wine. It's absolutely phenomenal. And they come out with these stories saying going back to Roman times and all this kind of stuff. But actually, wine is more of a modern thing. And really, it was during the 19th century that wine really, you know, kind of gained momentum, because prior to that, you know, wine was shipped in barrels and all of that kind of stuff around and by sea, you know, around Europe and to America and elsewhere. You know, the wines weren't particularly stable. And really, when you think about the 19th century, there were huge technologies that took place. You know, wines went from being a cottage industry into a commercial industry. And that was enabled by technology, which includes, you know, kind of presses, lever presses, and of course, steam powered machinery, and not least machine made bottles. So really that was all happening, particularly between the 1850s and 60s. So we really look at Australian wine has developed at the same time as the modern wine industry in the world has developed. And Cabernet was first brought into Australia in the 1830s, certainly by James Busby. But I'm not so sure that that particular stock material was that brilliant. So in 1837, Sir William MacArthur, who was running Camden Nurseries south of Sydney, he actually ordered a whole lot of vine cuttings that came in 1837. And those were Cabernet Sauvignon, Petit Verdot, Malbec. And this vine stock material landed up being planted in various places in South Australia. places like Ronella, which is just on the way to McLaren Vale, but also vine stock material. This type of 19th century heritage was planted in Tacunawara. And I find that these stories are really fascinating because they really show, you know, how visionary Australian pioneers really were.
And how far back to compare, you know, does Cabernet date in Bordeaux, for example?
Oh, well, Cabernet is a really ancient variety, but in terms of its fame really didn't start until around the 1850s and the 1860s. And it didn't really start, Cabernet, with its fame until the classification of Bordeaux in 1855, which took place at the International Paris Exhibition in 1855, the same exhibition in which wines from New South Wales were being shown by Sir William MacArthur and shown and presented to Emperor Napoleon III and Queen Victoria.
We hear again and again about how reasonably priced top wines such as these are in comparison to their old world counterparts. Are we going to see that this might put some pressure on prices and that those of us who've been enjoying being able to buy John Riddoch at current pricing might get priced out of the market?
I think we're way off that. Yeah. Way off that. I mean, you know, I think everyone in the end is quite, how does it affect me? And so I really have to put, you know, spin it round the other way and say, well, how does it affect the Australian wine industry? And, you know, the Australian wine industry needs to have wines that can be compared and contrasted with other finest wines in the world, like Domaine de la Romanée Conti or Chateau Lafite or Chateau Margaux or whatever. We have to be in that space as a wine industry, and it's really important for our reputation overseas. So the answer is wines like Wins John Riddoch, if this plan is successful, it will probably increase in value, but not for a long time because, you know, it's like a rolling stone. It takes a long time. So we're looking at a time frame of 20, 30 years before we really see a big effect on the consumer. On the other hand, behind these wines come other wines as well of similar quality and prestige. So, you know, as wine consumers, if you are really interested in wine and love wine, we all know that connoisseurship is not about money. It's about finding value. And I can give you a zillion different wines that are great value, that don't cost a lot of money, and are better than some of the so-called icon wines that are out there. So I think in the end, it's an interesting debate and a conversation, but fine wine lovers are always going to be able to drink fine wine, regardless of what's happening in the ultra fine wine markets.
Looking at these two wines specifically, last I checked, the Armagh, I think, was priced at about $300. Riddoch was somewhere more around $120, $150. And you've said that they've got, you know, very similar attributes of quality.
Yeah.
Why do we see this discrepancy in the price in Australia between premium Cabernet and premium Shiraz?
Well, I suppose I'm just trying to kind of go through my Teledex in my brain and, you know, think about all the other Cabernets out there. You know, there's the Penfolds Bin 707, get a hell of a lot of money.
True.
So, you know, I guess
I can think of a lot more examples of Shiraz that are up there than
true,
I can
but
Cabernet.
But a part of the reason for that is because there's a hell of a lot more Shiraz than there is Cabernet in this country. But saying that, there's two things. First of all, you know, for wines to operate in this ultra fine, you know, kind of space, the exceptional, you know, from a Langton's classification point of view space, the value proposition comes into play and therefore price. So if you look at something like Jim Barry the Amar, the pricing of that is probably reflective of the fact that it is a single vineyard wine and it's a small make and there's a high demand for it and a low supply. In terms of the Wins John Riddoch, I would say that is the most undervalued fine wine in this country by a factor of at least 100%. And it has been for a long time. And the reason for that is the marketeers in previous times have concentrated on things like the Black Label. And, you know, the Black Label is one of the great, you know, kind of fine commercial wine. In fact, it's actually in Langton's classification as well. But it kind of covers both the commercial wine markets and the ultra fine wine markets. You know, it's got a great narrative. It's one of the first wines that came out of Coonawarra. It's got, you know, all this wonderful provenance, and the wine's just so beautifully made, and they're reasonably good value. But if you actually even look at the black label and the prices of that, that's probably doubled in the last 10 years, maybe. Whereas John Riddick certainly hasn't. So John Riddick is lagging behind because it sits there, it's well regarded, but nothing much has been done with it. And this is the reason why I wrote that book.
Well, let's get on to that. Yeah. The book's called Imagining Coonawarra.
Yeah,
maybe give us a synopsis and a bit of a background as to how you came to write it.
And most of the negotiants, French negotiants, would have no idea what Wines John Riddick is. And so we needed to provide some form of information to really show that this wine has got a lot of substance behind it, which it does. And so I proposed to write a pamphlet. But like with many of my writing projects, pamphlets turn into essays and then essays come into books. And so this landed up becoming, you know, big. And so I actually approached Wines and said, well, will you fund it? And they said, yes. And I said, terrific. So I went back and wrote it. And so we've got this book. But, you know, the Wines John Riddick story goes back all the way back into the 1890s when the Coonawarra fruit colony was established. It was probably the first wine region in the world to be established on scientific principles. John Riddick brought in some of the great advisors of the time to really kind of analyze and see whether Coonawarra would be a potential wine region. He basically has this wonderful, on his land, this wonderful cigar-shaped weathered limestone and this extraordinary drainage underneath. And in fact, there's this huge underground lake, kind of artesian water that, you know, can be used for irrigation. I mean, this place is just amazing. And the Wines Coonawarra Estate winery, with that three-gabled winery, which is so famous on the label, that was built by John Riddick for the 1897 vintage. You know, this whole Wines Coonawarra Estate is really a continuum of John Riddick's vision. It dominated the wine Coonawarra just simply because of the number of vineyards it's got down there. But, kind of fast-tracking right up to the present day, you know, Sue Hodder, who, incidentally, I was at Rosebery Agricultural College with, so I've known
previous her. Guest on the Drinks Adventures podcast
who's such a wonderful person, and Sarah Pigeon have... not to mention, you know, Alan Jenkins and the viticultural team, of which one just won the Viticulturalist of the Year. They've done such a marvelous job, you know, with the vineyards, you know, making, you know, kind of, you know, precision viticulture, and all the things that they've done in renovating those vineyards is extraordinary. And the fidelity of winemaking is extraordinary. So, you know, all of these things combined, it just all kind of channels into this great opportunity. Because Wines Coonawarra Estate, John Riddick Cabernet Sauvignon, is seen as the pinnacle of the Coonawarra wine story.
I heard you say recently that if we want people in overseas markets to respect our wine and understand the quality of our wine, we have to have enough belief in the quality of it ourselves. Is there a cultural cringe in this country, do you think, with Australian wine?
I think there used to be. I don't think there is now. You know, I think because winemakers and wine marketeers were merchants, where everyone mingles, we all talk to each other now. It's a very much a global community. So I don't think so. But I do think that the Australian wine industry needs to back itself a little bit more in terms of that ultra-fine wine space. It's been very, very, very effective in selling commercial and masstige wines around the world. And they are extremely popular, profitable, and accessible to more of a general audience. And I think this is the thing about Australian wine, it's accessible to a general audience. And I think going back to La Place de Bordeaux, there are a lot of others that could be in that space. It's going to take a while because you know, this market is very traditional. You can't just, you know, dump a whole lot of different wines in there and expect it to sail. You know, this is not an easy way of selling wine until you've got that amazing reputation for quality.
Andrew, it's been a fascinating chat. We might leave it there. Where can people find the book, Imagining Coonawarra?
Well, Imagining Coonawarra is actually online as an ebook through Google or Apple. I think most people who will read it will find it fascinating. It doesn't take very long to read. It's only 30,000 words. I think you can read it in about an hour or an hour and a half. But it's also got some really interesting illustrations and points, and I think it's a pretty informative book.
Great stuff. Well, thanks very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.